I just slipped through an exam, and you're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
You're tuned in to the R1 News, your stop for news and current affairs on the airwaves. 11 to 12 weekdays here on Radio 1 91 FM. Te reo irirangi kotahi.
Tēnā koutou I tēnei ata. This is the R1 News here on Radio 1. Ko Seb aho.
Ko Scott aho. And we'll be taking you through the news here on Rapide, 4th of August. Coming up on the show, I tēnei rā, we have Sophie with the news headlines and weather.
Following that, we have a pre-recorded feature where I talk to Timothy Hazeldine, Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Auckland, about the record profits supermarket owners have been making over the last few years, why groceries are becoming so expensive, and when we can expect to see some change in the way the grocery sector is structured.
After this, I'll be talking to Professor of Psychology Cliff Abraham of the University of Otago about allegations of academic fraud made about a protein key in understanding Alzheimer's disease.
And then following on from that, we have another pre-recorded feature where I spoke to Lydia Chai, the creator of the petition to ban New Zealand's exports of plastic waste to developing countries in Southeast Asia.
And finally, we have a live chat with Andrew Johnston, our local zoologist, for Creature of the Week.
It's a pretty jam-packed show today, but before we can get all into that, here is Hardy and Claire with their song Big City.
Hey!
That was Hardy and Claire with their song Big City. You've got it tuned to the R1 News Show here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi Radio 1. And now it is time for the news headlines and weather with Sophie.
The R1 News Headlines.
Kia ora. These are your Radio 1 News Headlines for Thursday, the 4th of August. The Mental Health and Wellbeing Hub Otipoti Peer Support Group Lounge provides assistance and advice in a safe and welcoming environment. The hub is run by mental health organisation Wellness Empathy Kindness Aotearoa, WECA, and opened just over 3 months ago. Core team member Matthew Peppercorn said the aim of the lounge was to provide a space for people who are experiencing distress about their mental health, including self-harm, suicidal ideation, addiction relapses and other challenges. Quote, peer support means having lived experience of distress and using that experience to support others, unquote. Although the emergency psychiatric service did a good job, it was only for people who were, quote, on the paramount edge of emergency, unquote. Instead, the aim of the lounge was to provide earlier intervention. Accessibility was a key part of the aim, so people did not need a referral to visit. Quote, we are open to anybody, really, unquote. The upstairs hub at 42 Fallil Street includes an art space, kitchen, education rooms and quiet rooms. Community sessions include journal writing, positive thinking, stigma and discrimination, supporting distressed people, creative healing and mindfulness. The hub runs one-on-one sessions and gives advice to other health services available to people. The lounge is open 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. Wednesday to Saturday. Birmingham's Commonwealth Games has seen a huge morning for New Zealand sport. Hamish Kerr has taken the gold medal in the men's high jump and Auckland's Maddie Wesh has claimed bronze in the shot put. New Zealand women's 100 metre record holder Zoe Hobbs has placed 6th in the 100 metre final and David Litty has settled for silver in the men's 109kg plus weightlifting final. Sam Gaze and Ben Oliver won New Zealand gold and silver medals in the men's cross-country mountain bike race last night. New Zealand swimming star Lewis Kleber described his week as, quote, a dream come true, as he claimed his medal in the women's 200-metre individual medley race this morning. This after two Birmingham golds in the 200-metre butterfly and the 400-metre individual medley. Also in the pool this morning was Dunedin's Erica Fairweather, who placed 4th in the women's 400-metre freestyle. Paul Cole has made history for New Zealand, becoming the first Kiwi man to win a gold medal in the squash at the Commonwealth Games in a 95-minute marathon match. Flag bearer Joelle King has just missed out on a medal in her squash singles but will contest the women's double tomorrow with partner Amanda Landers-Murphy. Dunedin Railway Station has featured in recent Hollywood blockbusters like The Power of the Dog and now its 115-year-old exterior is in for a $7 million makeover. Quote, we are doing a complete paint of the whole building and restoring any original timberwork back to the original standard, unquote. Naylor Love project manager Paul Stevenson told News Hub. The building is being waterproofed and 15,000 tiles are being sent from the original France factory that supplied it over a century ago. Dunedin City Council Property Services Manager Anna Nelson said that the restoration will be hopefully finished by August 2023. It's hoped that this work will preserve the landmark for the next century. Dunedin totally swamped its July rainfall record by 412% last month and set a new record of 235 millimetres, the highest since records began in 1918. It was New Zealand's fourth hottest July on record, with the nation averaging almost 1.5 degrees warmer than normal across the month. Ongoing cloud created warmer than usual overnight temperatures from July 11 to 31. Five separate weather events brought flooding rain into the country, making for the staggering record rainfall. Those were your Radio 1 News headlines, and now for the weather.
The R1 News weather.
Today we will see morning cloud and then a fine and sunny afternoon with northerlies. There will be a low of 9 degrees and a high of 15. Tomorrow there is a wind warning in place. It will be cloudy at times with evening rain and northerlies, strong in exposed places. There will be a low of 9 degrees and a warm high of 17 degrees.
That was your news headlines and weather for Rapare 4th of August. That was Sophie Woodham, our fantastic news volunteer. Ngā mihi, Sophie. Now moving into our next segment. This is a pre-recorded feature with Timothy Hazeldine, Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Auckland, talking a little bit about the record profit that supermarket owners have been making over the last few years, why groceries are becoming so expensive, and when we can expect to see some change in the way the grocery sector is structured. Without further ado, here it is.
When the National Business Review released its 2018 Rich List, a new generation of millionaires were beginning to qualify for the list. Back then, individuals and families must have had at least $50 million in private wealth. Nowadays, the lowest entrant to the list qualifies with $100 million in wealth. 34 newcomers made the list in 2018, many of which had made their fortune in the grocery industry. Tim Hazeldine is an emeritus professor of economics at the University of Auckland. I talked to Tim about some of the reasons behind the wealth accumulation in parts of the supermarket sector.
As you know, there's two supermarket chains left in New Zealand, not many. One of them's owned by Australia, and they run Countdowns, Progressive Enterprises, and no one gets rich with them because they keep the ownership of the stores to themselves and just hire people to run the stores for about $150,000 a year for a store manager. But the other group is a co-op, a New Zealand co-op called Foodstuffs, and they have New World and Pack and Save, and they allow individuals to have a franchise, as they call it, for a single supermarket. You can only have a franchise for one supermarket, but that's probably going to be enough because quite a few of the people with those franchises have made it onto the rich list. So they're doing pretty well out of those franchises.
Do you see anything wrong with people profiting so much from what should be an essential service, you know, especially when ordinary Kiwis are experiencing rising costs every time they visit the grocery store?
Well, I mean, I don't see anything wrong with somebody getting rich if they, basically, if they contribute more than they take, you know. But this is a fairly routine business. I mean, your product is never going to go out of fashion, food. You know, it's an essential product. You're selling the same products that your competitors are, you know, the things on the shelves. And your head office is trucking it all into you. It's doing all the pricing, all the marketing. So it's, you know, it really isn't a particularly sort of enterprise that you might think would make people into millionaires.
In March of this year, the Commerce Commission released its final report of an investigation into the $22 billion groceries industry. Among other things, the report detailed how competition is not working well for consumers in the retail grocery sector, and how the two supermarket giants, Foodstuffs and Woolworths, could be making up to $430 million a year in excess profits. Hazeldine believes that even with the report having been released, there is little being done to address the lack of fair competition. So far, it has been the supermarkets themselves who have begun to voluntarily cease some of their more unfair practices.
I think not very much is being done. The industry itself has been a little bit frightened, and so they've volunteered to do things like really bad things they were doing, like when they sold land or they buy land and they put a covenant on it to stop anybody else using that land if it was resold to put a supermarket on, just to keep the competition away from their area. So they have a number of practices like that. But the basic problem is you've got a duopoly, a very settled duopoly in a very mature industry like groceries. It's not very hard for them to, without breaking the law around things, to just let the price structure go up to uncompetitive levels. And without bringing in more competition, that's not going to change.
And how long do you predict it will take until we begin seeing these, major third entrants bringing in some new competition?
Well, we may never see them. There's a German chain called Aldi, which operates in Australia quite successfully, which does own-brand stuff, smaller stores or smaller product range, and has lower prices. It'd be nice to see them in New Zealand, but apparently they're not really interested because we're not big enough to support all their own brand production. So it'd have to be someone coming and using, you know, basically the same products as everybody else, sanitarium and so on, but just selling them for less. And the only way I can see that will happen would be if government actually started to have joint enterprises, sort of Kiwi shops, if you like, perhaps in, you know, areas like South Dunedin or South Auckland, you know, areas where the people really do suffer if food prices are high.
So it's not the invisible hand of the market that's going to kind of, you know, increase competition if there are new entrants. You think there needs to be some kind of government intervention?
Yeah, as someone said, the invisible hand is all thumbs when it's drop of it. You need a lot of competitors to make the invisible hand work on pricing.
It's all thumbs, did you say?
Yeah, it's all thumbs. Someone said that once. Quite clever.
Wondering, Tim, is the duopoly a unique problem to New Zealand? Are there other countries that we can look at to see that, you know, that's the right level of competition, and that's probably a fair amount that supermarket owners should be making each year?
Well, that's a good question. And the people will say, we've got a small market, we can't have more than two. There are some industries, like brewing, for example, which is almost as old an industry as groceries, that even in big countries, like America, there's only three big brewers, and Australia, there's only two big brewers. We've got two here, of course, two, and plus the craft brewery. So some industries, we're the same as other countries, but I think in groceries and supermarkets, no, there's a lot more competition across the ditch in Australia, and places like America and Canada have big chains, but they have a lot of them. They have regional chains. They tend to have more players than we have, than a duopoly.
Commerce Commission Chairwoman Anna Rawlings has said that New Zealand was the sixth most expensive groceries market in the OECD in 2017, claiming that the level of profit being earned is persistently high. The uncompetitive market structure of New Zealand supermarkets, along with global supply chain issues caused by the COVID-19 pandemic and geopolitical conflict in Ukraine, has led to record high prices at the checkout. The government's cost of living payments intend to provide some relief to Kiwis who are suffering as a result of the rising cost of inflation, but Hazeldine believes that there is far more which needs to be done. In a time where many New Zealanders are finding it difficult to afford food, Hazeldine believes it's grotesque that a single supermarket can generate enough profit for someone to reach the rich list.
If you can get foodstuffs to finance you into a franchise, you've got a license to print money.
Right. So it's foodstuffs really that should be coming under the microscope more so than Woolworths.
Oh, no, not really. At least in foodstuffs, the profits stay in New Zealand.
Right.
Progressive is making the same profit margins at the same, basically selling at the same prices. And then that's all sucked back to Australia, just as it is with the big banks in New Zealand. So I'd rather have been ripped off by a Kiwi than ripped off by Aussies.
Fair enough, Tim. Thank you so much for joining me, mate. I hope you have a good rest of your day.
Yeah, same to you. Nice to talk.
All right. See you later.
Bye.
If you're just joining us now, that was Timothy Hazeldine, the Emeritus Economics Professor at the University of Auckland, speaking a bit about the record profit that supermarket owners have been making over the last few years. Coming up on the show, we've got Scott talking to the Professor of Psychology, Cliff Abraham, on the University of Otago's... Cliff Abraham of the University of Otago talking about allegations of academic fraud made about a protein that's key in understanding Alzheimer's disease. But before that, we've got a song. This is Frankie Cosmos with Floated In.
That was Floated In by Frankie Cosmos here on R1 News. An article published in Science 2 weeks ago has alleged that a number of papers associated with the discovery of an Alzheimer's disease-related protein contain tampered images. A six-month investigation by Science, prompted by the concerns of Vanderbilt University neuroscientist Dr. Matthew Shrug, found that over 200 images have been doctored in papers about amyloid beta protein 56 and potentially have misdirected Alzheimer's research since its discovery. Here to speak with us about the impact of this discovery is Professor Cliff Abraham of the University of Otago's Department of Psychology. Kia ora, Cliff.
Kia ora.
Amyloid beta 56 was discovered by Dr. Sylvain Lesny, Dr. Karen Ash, and their team at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities in 2006. Can you tell us about what they discovered and why it was important?
Yes, sure. So one of the key pathologies in the brain of people with Alzheimer's disease was the accumulation of insoluble proteins, in particular one that's called beta amyloid. And that was discovered quite a long time ago. And in the interim, it's been realized that actually this insoluble plaques, as they're called, does cause some disruption of the brain. But more importantly, when the plaques are just forming into kind of aggregates of this amyloid beta peptide, that those small aggregates are actually more toxic than the plaques themselves. And these researchers reported that a particular version of these soluble small aggregates is the particular cause for Alzheimer's disease. So they've studied a lot about this particular version of what is called an oligomeric amyloid beta peptide.
If these allegations are founded, this represents a significant flaw to the scientific process. How serious is scientific fraud, and how does the scientific community address it?
Well, of course, there's a lot of trust out there in the process of both running experiments and analyzing the data and reporting it in published papers, which, of course, goes out to peer review, and people are meant to be kind of on the lookout for any possible fraud. But this is extremely difficult to detect in many cases, particularly if people are being clever. And in these particular cases that have been brought to light, it's really about altering digital images of some of their data, which can be also very difficult to detect. So we don't really think that scientific fraud in neuroscience or any other area is that common, but of course, there are people involved, and there's always the temptation to do this. And it takes whistleblowers like the ones that you've been talking about to kind of bring some of these to light in many cases.
How will research into Alzheimer's disease be impacted by these findings, both here at Otago and internationally?
To be honest, I don't think there's going to be a great impact. Nobody else has really been studying this particular version of the amyloid beta peptide and how it aggregates. There's lots and lots of other data saying that various types of these aggregates are toxic and are a very good target for therapeutic strategies. So that work is still going to go on. Here at Otago, there is some work going on using these amyloid beta peptides, but the therapeutic strategies that people are working on aren't, to my knowledge, directly targeting reducing the numbers or amount of these peptides, but kind of doing workarounds to find alternative strategies that might have that effect, but might have other effects as well on the disease process. So I don't think there'll be any effect on what's going on here for research at Otago, and really internationally, people are still going to be actively pursuing strategies that reduce the plaque formation in Alzheimer's brains.
Kind of building on that for a second there, because amyloid beta and through case examples has kind of become a part of instruction in neuroscience, will teaching be impacted in any significant way?
Well, it would be a useful case study in scientific fraud and image manipulation. So that might come through in teaching. And certainly we talk about it in our labs with our lab groups. In terms of undergraduate teaching, I think the basic premises are still going to be brought forward, that amyloid beta accumulation in the plaques is part of the disease process. There's there are other things that are going on as well in terms of Alzheimer's disease, and I think more and more people are aware here at Otago and elsewhere that there's other changes in the brain that either come before the plaques or after the plaques that are also targets that could be used for therapies that we might develop. So I think that those same stories still hold, and those are the that's the information that'll be given to undergraduates and postgraduates. I think people become more and more mindful that one type of scientific fraud, digital manipulations, is something to keep a very careful eye on.
What are the next steps for the scientific community? Can we will a lot of the focus be about how we engage with people who might have disenfranchised with these allegations?
So who do you mean might be disenfranchised?
As in people who are, we're talking about, we're already in a time where trust in science, as we've seen with the COVID-19 pandemic, is relatively low, given where it has been over the last few years. Are people who are affected by Alzheimer's disease and their families, are we likely to see any disenfranchisement from them about these kind of allegations?
Look, I think that's potentially the most serious impact of any scientific fraud and in this area with Alzheimer's disease. I would say that people are probably more mindful of science these days because of the development of vaccines for the pandemic. So in some ways, there's more trust. And we really hate to see that erode because of these because cases of scientific fraud come out. I mean, it's terrible for the scientific community, but perhaps the worst thing is the potential for reducing trust in science. And one of the associated cases of fraud that you haven't even mentioned, but was discovered by the same whistleblowers, was around the supporting data for a current clinical trial of a drug. So those cases haven't been proven to be fraudulent. And in fact, even the original cases we discussed that looks like fraud and it acts like fraud, but actually showing it is fraud is still requires a lot more investigation. But so people undergoing clinical trials might be undergoing them under false pretenses, you might say. So so there are some significant potential impacts, and we just have to to hope that it doesn't go too badly, the trials, and also that we still have quite legitimate trials, many other legitimate trials going on that will carry the day in the end.
Professor Abraham, thank you for speaking with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That was Dr. Cliff Abraham of the University of Otago's Department of Psychology speaking about the recent allegations of academic fraud within Alzheimer's disease proteins and those pathways.
Coming up on the show, we've got a feature where I spoke to Lydia Chai, the creator of the petition to ban New Zealand's export of plastic waste to developing countries in Southeast Asia. But just before that, we've got the song Level Headed by Hans Puckett. You're listening to R1 News.
Out, so my life out. Say it, I'll forget.
You're listening to the R1 News Show here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi Radio 1. The time is 26 minutes to 12, and that song you just heard there was Level Headed by Hans Puckett. Coming up on the show, I spoke to Lydia Chai earlier this week, the creator of the petition to ban New Zealand's export of plastic waste to developing countries in Southeast Asia. Here's the conversation we had.
Last week, a petition urging the government to stop overseas exports of millions of kilograms of plastic waste was presented to Parliament, with activists raising concerns over health and environmental issues overseas. I sat down with Lydia Chai, the petition leader, who is urging the government to stop sending New Zealand's plastic waste to places such as Malaysia, which sees a significant portion of plastic waste exports from New Zealand. Kia ora, Lydia. First off, congratulations. Your petition on Action Station had over 11,000 signatures, and now you've officially presented it to Parliament. How does that feel?
It feels great to have the support of New Zealanders and supporting this kaupapa. It just shows that when New Zealanders know the right information, they want to do the right thing.
Am I right in saying that you handed the petition to the Green MP Eugenie Sage and National MP Scott Simpson? They were there to receive it at Parliament?
Yes, that's right.
Do you think there's a bit of cross-party support on this issue then?
Well, that was the impression that I got on the day. A Member of Parliament, Scott Simpson, was very receptive to the issues that I was presenting, and he spoke very well on it and was very open, as was Eugenie Sage. So I'm quite optimistic about a cross-party collaboration on this.
Lydia, could you tell us a bit, can you give us a bit of background on the issue of plastic waste? Just a bit of an explainer as to where it's going, who's it affecting, and why it's such a problem?
Yeah, okay. Well, just a part of history, I guess, starting from 2018. So all along, we have been exporting our plastic waste to China. And in 2018, China said, no, we're not accepting any more waste. And so we diverted our waste to Southeast Asia. In fact, a lot of the operators that started up in Southeast Asia were actually operators from China benefiting from the diversion of the plastic waste. And so the waste trade moved to Southeast Asia. So since then, Southeast Asia has been the, so to speak, dumping ground of the world. Most OECD countries send their waste to Southeast Asia. Now, when I talk about plastic waste, I'm referring to hard plastics, not soft plastics, because that can't be exported anymore since 2018 as well. So hard plastics refers to drinks bottles, containers, hard to recycle plastics. And a lot of New Zealanders wouldn't know that we actually export most of our hard plastics recycling to Asia. It's about 90% is going overseas, and I think a lot of New Zealanders would be disappointed to know that we are not processing it onshore.
I think it is very disappointing news. You know, Kiwis often have this clean, green conception of themselves as a country, but it's not quite the truth, is it?
No. And I guess the other side of the story is what happens when it arrives in these countries. So as a general rule, these countries have very lax environmental laws, very lax enforcement. So on the ground, yes, some plastics get processed and recycled, or mostly downcycled, but there's the issue of contamination, which is still like a large amount of contamination, and that is the amount that for sure gets burned or buried or dumped illegally. And it's not just contaminated bales that get burned. It's things like, let's say, plastic bales get onsold to other operators, often illegal operators, and they are the ones who do a lot of the dumping and burning because they're getting chased by local authorities. So they just have to flee the scene and they just dump their rubbish there. So on the ground, that's what's happening. And my whole, the whole point of my petition is that we cannot know for sure what happens to the plastic once it leaves our shores. We can do all that we can to make sure that our plastic bales have the minimum amount of contamination. However, when it gets to these receiving countries, we have no control. And I think a lot of New Zealanders don't know that there's rife corruption in these places. Southeast Asia is well known for having widespread corruption. And in the case of Malaysia, I can tell you that there's no local council elections. So whichever councillor or local official who is handing out these environmental permits, we don't know if they're legitimate or not.
To that end, Lydia, could you tell us a bit, could you tell us anything of your personal experience with the issue of plastic waste? You know, what inspired you to do something about it?
Well, what inspired me was that these burnings are happening very near my hometown in Malaysia. So a lot of my family still live there. And because it's discharged to the air, it's inevitable that my family's breathing in these toxic fumes. And it's not just in the air, it's plastic, microplastics leaching into waterways, leaching into the ground because they're being buried. And just the environmental and health hazard that it's having an effect on. I've said publicly that there's evidence that cancer and asthma rates have gone up ever since the waste trade started up in 2018.
It's dreadful to hear the reality of the situation, and it's so far removed from us here in New Zealand. Do you think that without the option of sending our plastic overseas, do you think it means that we'll be forced to deal with the problem here on a pretty fundamental level, you know, using plastic less or transitioning to a more circular economy?
Yeah, so there's two parts to this. The first part is, what do we do with our recycling? I think that if we look at the story of soft plastics, we can see that what happened there was that by not exporting our soft plastics, we were able to incentivize local companies to deal with the soft plastics. And we're seeing so many different local initiatives to deal with soft plastics. Ironically, the soft plastics that we wash and dry and put in the correct collection points has a bigger chance of being processed safely than the hard plastics that we're putting into our bins. And the second part to that question is, what do we do to reduce our plastic? And I think it's a behavioral change that needs to happen. We need to transition to a truly circular economy, not just downcycling, which is kicking the can down the road, but truly recycle things, truly reduce our consumption of plastic. And there's lots of leadership being shown in from New Zealand organizations such as Takeaway Throwaways, The Rubbish Trip, Thumbs Up New Zealand. There's a lot of zero waste initiatives that are educating the public on this.
What do you have to say to Kiwis who really want to make a difference and they're diligently trying to do their recycling, you know, in a bid to reduce their burden on the environment? What do you have to say to these Kiwis who just aren't aware of this issue?
Well, the simplest thing to do would be to sign my petition before it closes. So if you Google Lydia Chai Action Station, you can find my petition online. That's one way of pressurizing the government to do something, because I think it's a large systemic issue, and the burden shouldn't solely be on individual shoulders to bear, because the systems make it really hard for us to wean ourselves off plastic. But on an individual day-to-day level, I guess it would be great if everyone just considered, before buying a plastic bottle of water or drink bottle, just thinking twice before you buy something and just reducing your reliance on plastic.
Thinking twice before you buy. Yeah, that's really good advice, Lydia. Thank you so much. And thank you for joining me, and thank you for starting this really important conversation that needs to happen and shedding some light on some of the really horrible things that are happening, you know, out of sight for a lot of Kiwis. It's important to bring it to the forefront of public consciousness, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. And the one thing that I'm grateful for this petition is that it's actually educated a lot of people who didn't know otherwise. So if nothing happens, at least I've managed to tell people what's actually happening.
At least you've started the conversation, exactly. And you've definitely started it within the airwaves of Radio 1 and Otupoti Dunedin. So for that, I thank you, Lydia. And yeah, again, thanks for the work you're doing, and thank you for joining me. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your evening.
Thanks, Sebastian.
The next step in the petitions process is that it will be looked at by the Environment Select Committee, after which Lydia will have to present evidence to the committee before they decide whether or not to make a recommendation on banning plastic exports to Parliament. The official parliamentary petition has closed. However, Lydia's Action Station petition remains open with 11,500 signatures.
If you're just joining us now, that was Lydia Chai, the creator of the petition to ban New Zealand's export of plastic waste to developing countries in Southeast Asia. You've got it tuned to the Rapara show for R1 News. The time is 15 minutes to 12. Early in the show, we had a feature where I talked to Auckland economics professor Timothy Hazeldine about the record profits that supermarkets in New Zealand have been making in the last few years. We also talked about the uncompetitive nature of the groceries industry, with only two main entities controlling all the main supermarkets in the country. I thought it was only appropriate to play this next song at some point in the show. It's by a fantastic Kiwi band, Owen the Moe, and it's called Supermarket Kings. It's a pretty gorgeous way of commenting on the supermarket duopoly that we currently live under. So here it is.
Save the chance, it's a for one above the looks.
This is the R1 News on Radio 1 91 FM. Te reo irirangi kotahi.
You got it tuned to the R1 News Show. My name is Seb, and the time is 11 minutes to 12. The song you just heard then was Owen the Moe. Sorry, it was Supermarket Kings. It was by the band Oh and the Moe. Now coming up on the show, we have a very exciting segment. We've got local zoologist Andrew Johnston joining me on the show. Kia ora, Andy.
G'day, kia ora, how are you?
Welcome to Creature of the Week.
Yes, thank you, I'm so excited. I love this segment so much.
Great time of the week.
It's amazing, it's my favourite.
What are we talking about today?
Well, today I've got a bit of a challenge for myself, to maybe with some of the listeners as well. But first, with you, Seb, what's your opinion on pigeons?
Rats of the sky.
Yeah, see, I thought so. See, and you might have the same sentiment as a lot of our listeners as well.
I say that, but then I can also... There are some beautiful elements of mm-hmm. the pigeon. There are some times when the sun hits pigeon in a certain mm-hmm. way, they mm-hmm. have the most beautiful, like, plumage. Mm-hmm. It's like
metallic, almost.
Yeah,
it's like
but it can be purple
Purple. It's like this... Yeah. It's like glistening. Well,
I think let's scratch the surface a bit.
That's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to try and convince everyone here, including yourself and the listeners, that pigeons are actually incredible. That they're an amazing species. So listen to the whole thing.
I'm ready. Well, because we did a similar thing last week with grey-white sharks.
We kind of turned
fear into fascination.
That's all.
And now we're kind of turning disgust into fascination.
Yeah, I agree. And there's a lot to be fascinated about with pigeons, for sure. I think straight off the bat, something to understand is that pigeons were actually domesticated. Right, so the current pigeon that we have at the moment within our cities is an ancestor of something called a rock dove, which was in the Middle East. And now these pigeons that are here are actually more, could be referred to as feral or stray, rather than actually wild.
Right.
So it's almost like a stray dogs or stray cats, stray birds, because we actually, as humans, domesticated them 6,000 years ago in the Middle East and have kept them throughout humanity and kept them with us, and now they're still here today.
That's crazy. Does that mean we've kind of changed them as animals, like on a pretty fundamental level? Have they evolved in a certain way since they've come into contact with you?
Alongside us, yeah. So now they've kind of got to this point where they're also dependent on living in civilizations and within cities. So they need us, and just how back in the day, we needed them.
Wow.
So, yeah.
And what are some of the things humans have needed pigeons for? Why did we choose them?
So they were the first bird we ever domesticated as humans, and we domesticated them primarily for two reasons. One was for their meat, so we could have them as a food source, as a protein source, and the other thing was for their dung to be used as sort of for agricultural reasons, for fertilizers and whatnot in our crops. But we didn't necessarily capture them and breed them, select a breed, whatnot. We more just encouraged them to live within civilizations and live with us.
Mm.
So it's less like the idea of dogs, where we have slightly bred them to be more tame or slightly bred them to be more big or hunting or whatnot. They've just sort of been growing with us.
An accidental domestication.
Yeah, just sort of been with us about 6,000 years. So they're pretty much one of our oldest friends, kind of alongside sort of like dogs and whatnot as well. Really,
man's
really
second best friend.
Our friend of the sky, maybe.
Yeah,
but since then they've been used for a lot of reasons. You know, like primarily, you might know that pigeons have had a lot of impact with war and even with messages and stuff like that. So
carrier pigeon mail.
So pigeons have this incredible ability to be able to go back to their home. So you can attach a message to them, and they'll be able to fly. I think it's something like 800 kilometers in total. Mm. They'll be able to figure out where home is, and they'll be able to fly all the way back home. So that's something that we don't fully understand yet. We think that it might have something to do with magnetic fields or the position of the sun or even smells or something like that. But we don't fully understand how birds can just fly in areas they've never seen before. They've never been before. And they can pinpoint exactly where home is and fly all the way home.
Breadcrumbs.
It's a Hansel and Gretel. Exactly.
Yeah, no, that's an amazing skill. And you mentioned war.
Yes. Oh, okay. So pigeons. I don't know. Pigeons have been involved in every major war we've ever had as humanity. They've been fighting alongside us, which is crazy. So, in 1940, I found some facts here. In 1940, the American Signal Pigeon Corps consisted of about 3,000 soldiers, and they had about 54,000 pigeons. with
my
them
God.
As well. So there was more pigeons than there were soldiers within this corps.
God, yeah. Think of all the pigeon veterans out there.
I know, exactly. And I there's this thing that is awarded within the war. It's called a Dickens Medal.
Yeah.
So what a Dickens Medal is that it's a medal that's specifically for animals that fight within war.
Right.
So if the animal is involved in warfare and they've done something courageous, they get given a Dickens Medal. So of the 54 Dickens Medals that were ever awarded during World War II, 32 of them went to pigeons. So majority of these medals
valiant
went towards
little heroes.
Yeah,
eh?
they were heroes. I mean, they've been credited with saving thousands of lives on the battlefield by being able to deliver messages to, you know, stop attacks or cause retreats or anything.
They're
kind of heroes, honestly.
That's
like
so cool. I'm not sure if you've brought this as a fact, but I think it's fascinating. Have you heard of pigeon-guided missiles?
No, tell me.
I thought you were going to bring this up. Pigeon-guided missiles were this thing, B.F. Skinner. If you've ever done a psychology paper, you've probably come across Skinner.
Mm-hmm.
He was the guy behind operant conditioning.
Yes.
He was hired by some military, probably the U.S. military, but, like, you know, it rings probably pretty true that it's the U.S. military training pigeons to guide missiles. But basically, before there were, you know, like AI-guided guided missiles, heat-guided missiles, there were these missiles designed to be guided by pigeons. And Google it to verify it. It's super crazy because the images of it are crazy. Pigeons would literally look in a certain direction or peck in a certain direction to guide the missile within it.
Oh, wow.
So I guess used for probably pretty, you know, inhumane acts of war. It's not the best thing pigeons have ever done. Nor is it the best thing Skinner has ever done.
He was a
brilliant psychologist. But
it does show that relationship between like animals and humans and how we do kind of coexist and have done some, if not
crazy stuff
not
together.
Good, but like incredible things. Like,
yeah.
Like, very, very interesting things. Absolutely.
The pigeon-guided missiles got discontinued once they found, you know, slightly more practical ways
good.
To guide missiles. Yeah.
But
it's kind of thank God, because that'd be a lot of pigeons being misused.
Not very nice, not very nice. And that's what we're here today to talk about, is how that these pigeons should be actually maybe respected when you go out there and you see a pigeon on the street. They're actually really, really cool.
I guess a conception that a lot of people would have with pigeons is they're yucky and dirty and carriers of disease. Is that true?
Well, that's actually a bit, again, of a misconception. Sorry, I'll get the word out there eventually. Bit of a misconception, because, you know, so do they have diseases? Yes, potentially, but no more than any other wild animal out there.
Right.
So they're not like riddled with them, or they're not like they don't have heaps and heaps of them. And the other thing is that when we talk about disease, we talk about how easy it is for a disease to transfer from an animal to a human.
Yeah.
And when it comes to pigeons, it's not that easy. I mean, if it was so easy for pigeons to transfer their disease to everyone, then everyone would be sick all the time, because pigeons are out in our cities all the time. So they don't actually transfer between pigeons and humans very often at all. So yeah, it's a bit of a misconception.
It seems like a pretty common pastime to go down to your local park or pond or whatever and feed them some bread. They're pretty great because they're pretty comfortable with you.
Yeah.
They'll come and climb on your arm and you feel like a pirate with a cat on your shoulder.
you do.
Should we be doing that?
Yeah, well, what you can do if you're here in Dunedin is that you can go down to the Dunedin gardens, the Botans, and you can get some like seed mixture, because that's what they prefer to eat. Pigeons are technically omnivores, so they'll eat anything, but primarily what they eat is grains and seeds and those kind of things, and then they'll supplement that with some insects here and there, but they definitely don't eat human food. They don't really eat bread or fast food, or they shouldn't, at least. It's not good for them. So you can go down to the Botans and you can have some, get some seed there, and they'll come up on you and they'll climb on you and you can feed them, and they're really pretty, and it's such a good way to be able to see that gorgeous plumage that we were talking about earlier in the show and how amazing that is. So really, really awesome stuff.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
And doves, are they much different?
I'm not sure how similar they are, but they must be very similar. I mean, because pigeons are descendants from things called rock doves. So
right.
There's definitely a strong link.
I guess there's a funny incongruence and conception of doves and pigeons. Doves are known as these, like, you know, it's a symbol of peace.
Yes,
and like
they,
you know, when you think of like divine things, you kind of think of doves, but then pigeons just kind of get the nasty end of the stick.
Yeah, and maybe they should. You know, that's what I think. You know, that maybe they're very similar. I actually read somewhere that, you know, the dove in the Bible that brings the leaf after after Noah, whatever, there actually been a mistranslation, and it might have actually been a pigeon that did that. So, you know, so maybe they've just had the short stick the whole time.
Biblical animals.
Yeah. And I like to leave one cool fact, I think, that I found, which was that pigeons delivered the results for the first Olympics in 776 BC, and they delivered Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo 2,500 years later.
Oh, my God.
So they've just been with us for all these important, amazing events throughout history.
God damn.
Really cool.
Fantastic. Yeah. Andrew, thank you, man.
Of course.
You've definitely changed my perception.
Yeah, if you're listening, hope maybe may say thank you to a pigeon.
Get yourself down to the Botans and go thank the pigeons for all the valiant work they've done for us as humans and our co-evolution together.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you, Andy. It's been a fantastic Creature of the Week, mate. I can't wait to see what's next week. Mm-hmm. We've had a pretty jam-packed show here on the Rapere News Show for R1 News. At the top of the show, I spoke to Timothy Hazeldine, Emeritus Professor of Economics at Auckland University, about the record profits supermarket owners have been making over the last few years. And then following that, my co-host Scott talked to the Professor of Psychology, Cliff Abraham, about allegations of academic fraud made about a protein that's key in understanding Alzheimer's disease. And then after that, I talked to Lydia Chai, the creator of the petition to ban New Zealand's export of plastic waste to developing countries in Southeast Asia. And then you just heard us with Andrew Johnson, our favourite zoologist here in Otepoti, talking about pigeons. I'm going to leave the show now. It's 12 o'clock. It's my time to evacuate the booth, but I'm going to leave you with a song. It's by an amazing band from Ponake, Recitals, and it's called Rock Dove, which, funnily enough, is what pigeons descend from. So we love poetic justice here at Radio 1. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. But find more at r1.co.nz.